Hello and welcome to the Good Mood Podcast. My name is Dr. Talia Marcagiani. I'm a naturopathic doctor and I have dedicated my practice to learning everything there is to know about optimizing mental and emotional health. In this podcast, we answer the question, what does it take to live a life of truth, beauty, freedom, vitality, purpose, and joy? In a mix of solo episodes and interviews, I'll be talking about all the things that fascinate me, nutrition, nature, the latest science, psychology and psychotherapy, mindfulness and meditation, supplementation, and more. I'm so excited to have you here. Hello. In this episode, I talked to my friend and colleague, Dr. Katie Thompson-Aitken, a naturopathic doctor practicing in Guelph, Ontario, who has a special focus in anxiety and men's mental health. In this episode, Katie and I talk about the unique issues men experience with their mental health, including some hormonal underpinnings that drive mental health issues in this population. We also talk about how to manage anxiety and stress. When is it appropriate to stay with emotions versus spring into action to manage strong emotions like anxiety and panic, among many other topics? Dr. Katie is currently working on a book and offers a program to help manage anxiety and stress called the Tranquil Minds Program. In the show notes, I'll link to her site, her Instagram, and her Facebook community. Welcome, and I hope you enjoy this episode.
We are recording. So hello, everyone. This is Dr. Katie, not Dr. Talia. And Dr. Katie,
would you
introduce her? She's one of my colleagues, and she also has a mental health focus. And Katie, do you want to talk about your practice?
For sure. Yeah, so Talia mentioned, I'm also a naturopathic doctor. My practice does have a mental health focus. Specifically, I treat a lot of anxiety. And I also treat a lot of men's mental health, so stress management, depression, anxiety. My practice is in Guelph, Ontario. So Talia and I graduated together, so we've been practice the same amount of time.
We graduated in 2014, the magic year. And the reason Katie and I are chatting, well, there's many reasons, but one of the main reasons is that we had a question on our group about men's mental health. And one of the things that I talk about a lot, certainly, are the hormonal connections to mental health conditions. And a lot of that is in the context of my main patient population, who are women. So we talk about estrogen, progesterone, but we also talk about blood sugar, cortisol. So we're talking hormones. We're not just talking female hormones. But we want to come on and talk about some of the underlying mechanisms that can drive male depression and anxiety, but also some of the unique mental health concerns and issues that men might face when it comes to their mental health. So, Katie, what do you often see when it comes to hormonal underpinnings of mental health issues in men?
For sure. I think one of the things that is that's important to open with when we start conversations about men's mental health is to acknowledge how underdiagnosed men's mental health conditions are. A lot of times we talk about the higher rates in women and talk about mental health as a women's health problem. And that's very important. But I think there's a real, and there's some others that agree with me that there's a real problem with underdiagnosis in men. And so we're having to find those patients. And some of the problems are, one, not knowing what the symptoms are. So sometimes men experience physical signs of anxiety or physical signs of depression, more so than they're acknowledging or experiencing some of those like more emotional symptoms that cause women to go to the doctor. And so there's that disconnect of like not seeing that as anxiety or depression. And then there's also cultural influences. And I don't want to spend like forever on this piece, but the patriarchal system that we live in makes it very difficult for men as a population to own up and say, I'm not doing very well, or to have it implement or have it affect their work. And so this is a topic that I think is like really, really important. And because a lot of these things affect men in the same way that they affect women, but also there are unique challenges to men. And I see that from my practice, and from, you know, the men in my life, some of whom who have, you know, had anxiety or depression. And that it affects them just the way that it affects women. It affects their work performance, affects their relationships, affects their sleep. And so, yeah, I'm really glad you brought me on to talk about this.
Yeah. I have a couple questions for you. Yeah. So, I mean, I also want to acknowledge that we are two women talking about men's mental health.
Yeah.
But I think it's also appropriate because I actually did have, I have a colleague who is a male psychotherapist and you know, sometimes when it's a male talking about male mental health, there can be a little bit of tension there because we're not talking about, you know, we're not trying to exclude women in this conversation either, right, Katie? Like, we're just talking about some of the, I feel like in a lot of the conversations I have, it's mostly, we're understanding that a lot of these issues are women's issues because that's my main patient population. Mm-hmm. We wanted to specifically address questions about men. And I know, yeah, what you were saying before, I know we had a conversation one time where you were saying that the word anxiety is not always a word that a lot of your male patients connect to. They don't always identify with having anxiety.
It'll for sure. Stress. And some of them do. Mm-hmm. Some of them do resonate with that word, but some of them don't. And so definitely getting clear on like, what are the physical symptoms that that someone's experiencing? Are they having like a racing heart? Are they having digestive upset? Are they having headaches and tension? And when I'm encountering those concerns, just getting an understanding of what else could be contributing to those concerns from a mental health perspective, as well as addressing, obviously, if there are physical concerns, we want to rule those out. But once they have been, supporting the anxiety. And I know, Talia, you and I both talk a lot about blood sugar, but this is probably the first thing that I look at assessing in the anxious men that come into my practice. I see this a lot when work performance is disrupted in the afternoon, sort of feeling like I'm just not feeling myself. It's like after lunchtime and I'm just not, you know, I'm not performing in sales meetings or those sort of things come up. And I've actually found, you know, often we start doing blood sugar screenings, often we're finding that folks in that category are sometimes pre-diabetic. Mm-hmm. And that's actually the sign that's caused them to come in and get that proper diagnosis. So we can start modifying how they're eating, supporting proper glucose metabolism, just like we would in women. Sometimes that anxiety can be the presenting symptom of pre-diabetes. I don't know. Do you find the same thing?
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because you're sort of like, what do we understand when it comes to our physical, mental, emotional symptoms and what's actually driving things? So we talk about maybe not resonating with the label anxiety, but knowing that anxiety in itself is still a label because there isn't really like a blood test you can do to test if you have anxiety. Whereas you can test your blood and see if you have blood sugar dysregulation, which is a pre-diabetes or diabetes. And so it's actually what you may have called anxiety. So maybe you called it stress at first, you know, or I'm fatigued or I'm stressed. And then you're like, oh, well, that sounds like you have a lot of the signs and symptoms of anxiety. And then you dig a little bit deeper and you find out, oh, it's pre-diabetes. So we sort of like gone through the layers to find the biological, the biochemical underpinnings, the hormonal underpinnings of something that, took us down this deeper path.
Yeah. The other category that I think is worth mentioning is thyroid. Mm-hmm. And I know we talk about because hypothyroidism is so much more common in women than it is in men. We often talk about, you know, screening for depression with screening thyroid in women, but I have found this to be very helpful in men as well, both hypo and hyperthyroidism, and subclinical hypo and hyperthyroidism. And sometimes those presenting symptoms again are mostly depression or anxiety. And so, you know, men coming into the office, not feeling themselves, feeling really anxious, we're doing some blood tests and like, finding that their thyroid has been slightly overactive, but overactive enough that, that's, you know, sometimes they're getting medical care for those kind of things to pull them back into like more ideal ranges. And so,
Right. So anxiety is another symptom of something else that's going on under the surface, essentially.
Yeah, definitely. So that's an area that we're obviously screening for, Be that with like our symptom inventories and or through blood work. It's like, could there be something going on in the thyroid that's causing either anxiety, depression, or just feeling like I'm not coping, I'm not myself. You know, this isn't me.
What do you, so actually I wanted to ask you, I wanted to ask you what got you into focusing on men as a patient population?
Yeah.
Having a special niche there.
That's a great question. I think a lot of the time I'm tempted to say I just stumbled into it, but that's not entirely true, but it is partially true. When I graduated from naturopathic college, I knew I wanted to treat anxiety and treat mental health. And as I, you know, grew my relationship with my patients, there's a certain yin and yang, there's a certain balance in my practice when I'm working with men, and I find them very motivated, and that my methodology is very effective when I'm working with professional men. Mm-hmm. And so that's work that I just really love to do. Mm-hmm. And then also from a personal perspective, I don't want to share too much because it's not my story, but mm-hmm. how I'm wording it these days is I've been on the other side of the mattress. Mm-hmm. You know, my partner has had not major mental health concerns, but you know, like mild depression. And mm-hmm. that can be, you know, as someone who has sat through that from a marriage perspective, I know what it's mm-hmm. like, how that influences relationships, work, family. I've seen it. Mm-hmm. And I also know how little attention this topic is getting. Mm-hmm. And that's really what it is. That's actually one of the reasons why I'm very passionate about men's mental health is we're missing it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, I was looking at a study, the suicide rate for men in their 50s is going up right now.
Right.
And
typically typically I think the statistic is that men are more successful at suicide attempts. And I don't like the word successful, but they commit suicide to completion.
They choose more lethal means.
Yeah. So
that was usually, so previously, the demographics, I guess we'll put a content warning for this one now that we've
done. Yes. We'll put a TW, click warning or trigger warning. Yes.
But, the previous statistics were that a lot of this was in young men, and it was considered, you know, in older men, in men in their, you know, 40s and 50s, that this was really, you know, occasional suicide if there was you know, extreme changes in the stock market, or it was sort of seemed to be tied to like economics. I don't know how factual that was, but I know that was the assumption. What we're understanding now is that like it is not tied to those things. Mm-hmm. That is not what is happening. We have just regular mental health problems that affect all humans. And I guess the reason that I am like very pro men's mental health is that I'm a feminist, and I think that this is like my strange feminist issue that we are missing the mental health of this population. And there are people that are being hurt and harmed because we're just not paying attention.
I think, for me, feminism has always been about being able to participate as women in the hero's journey. Mm-hmm. So, right. Not just being supporting role of the hero's journey, being able to have our own hero's journey, but then we also want to support the hero journey in men as well, and their ability
to allow all humans the richness of human experience.
Exactly.
And when we say that certain people have to behave certain ways, we take away the power of human expression, of vulnerability in a way that is very, very harmful. Mm-hmm. As women, we've had a chance to, and are still working on, like rewriting our social scripts and our social narratives. And, you know, like I have a lot of privilege in the way that I've been able to do that. And I think when we talk about men, there's a privilege there as well. But that doesn't mean that they don't also have the right to say, like, this isn't working for us. Mm-hmm. Let's redefine what that means. And so I'm not going to be, one to say how masculinity should be to be redefined, or what being a man is should be redefined. I don't think that that's my role, but, you know, in listening to men that are working on this to promote men's mental health, that's a message I can get behind.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Totally. That's great. That's, yeah. I totally get that, right? It's like, you don't necessarily need to be of a patient population to have direct experiences with the suffering that goes on within that population and to be directly affected by it personally. You know, when someone you love is dealing with that and seeing the challenges that they face as a man. I wanted to ask about testosterone because I know that's probably going to come up. Yes. What do you see? And do you see that as being like a major player hormonally in causing depression, anxiety, or other mental health conditions? Or where do you see the connection there?
Yeah, it's there. I would put it, I honestly see blood sugar more often.
Right.
As a higher driver than testosterone's the problem. Mm-hmm.
And cortisol. Let's.
Yeah, we'll get to cortisol.
Yes. Definitely.
To be tested. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, I'm sure you get into talking about this when you're talking about like PCOS and like the hormonal connections around this, but it's actually the same thing in men's hormones. Similar that when you have dysglycemia and you have changes in adipose tissue, then you get different levels of aromatase, which then decreases testosterone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then Absolutely. It's like the chicken egg problem where you don't have the testosterone to drive the muscle mass.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have the testosterone for good mental health. And then another thing that ends up when you start talking about testosterone is, of course, libido.
Mm-hmm.
And we end up with this chicken egg problem with depression and libido, particularly, I think in women too, but I'm going to talk about men's health, where you see this huge correlation between not having a great sex drive or having something affect your sexual performance, which we know can happen with low testosterone.
Absolutely.
And then having depression. And it's like, okay, what started first here? And a lot of times it's not clear where this really came from. And so rather than just say, oh, that's just the depression, that's because you're on antidepressants and just like stopping, like run hormone panels and find out, like, is the testosterone optimal? Because sometimes it's not.
Mm-hmm.
We can support that. We can help the body make more testosterone.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of like in women's health, right? Like, so, I mean, the word hormones, we typically associate with sex hormones. So testosterone, estrogen, progesterone. And so a lot of people want to get their hormones tested because they feel hormonal. Like, we kind of know, like, especially women, like, they know differences around their cycles.
Yeah.
But what I often see even in women is that there are other things driving it. So whether you have estrogen dominance or low progesterone, we're thinking adrenals, we're thinking blood sugar, we're thinking how your liver's functioning, your digestive system. Same thing with men. It's like a lot of men, at least my patients, I don't know about you, they come in like, I want to get my testosterone tested because I feel like it could be low testosterone. But the recommendations we're generally making are, you know, regulating blood sugar, managing stress, working out, potentially weight loss if that's a factor, right? Because we talk about, you know, fat cells can cause an imbalance in estrogen and decrease.
For sure.
Yeah,
I typically don't recommend weight loss to deal with that, but that's, we can talk about that.
Right. Blood sugar regulation.
Blood sugar regulation all the way. Let's get those blood lipids to where we want to see them.
Let's
take functional biomarkers that are meaningful.
Well, and liver function is a big one, right? Because if you're not processing estrogen properly and it's accumulating, then that's going to cause issues with with that testosterone estrogen balance, for sure.
Exactly. And it's the same, right? There's a testosterone estrogen balance in men and women.
Yeah.
We just have to make sure that it doesn't look the same. It's not the same balance, but it still has to be balanced for that individual.
Absolutely. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. And again, like, you know, when we start talking about modifying these things, you know, I'm happy to work with patients where they're at. You know, sometimes it's just, you know, what someone wants is just to know what's going on in their body. And then they're going to go in and tackle that the way that they choose. And I have a lot of respect for that. But my methodology is very similar to yours. It's like, let's do the lifestyle foundations. Because we know that when people are sleeping well, when they eat well, when they move, when they take some time for peace and quiet, and when they connect to others, that creates a hormonal environment when it comes to thyroid, when it comes to blood sugar, when it comes to cortisol, when it comes to our sex hormones, like all those things come together in those foundational pieces. And I find so often is when we can set those right, we actually don't need to do anything else.
Absolutely. Yeah. When we're talking about testosterone replacement and those kind of interventions, it's like, but if we've set the foundations, then everything sets itself. And balances that.
And I'm not saying that to be, you know, to say it's either or, because it's not. Sometimes it's both and. It's like, let's get some help going. So you've got some energy. So you've got some improved mood, some improved sleep. And then let's use that momentum to rebuild those foundations so that you are as strong and healthy as you can be. Because that's, I don't know, that's what I want for my patients.
Totally. Yeah, totally. Yeah, we were talking about like the pyramid, right? It's like setting the foundations, addressing deficiencies, removing excesses, and then balancing. And balancing usually, like when those other two foundations are in place, rebalancing things is a lot quicker and faster. When we're talking about cortisol, we're talking about blood sugar, testosterone, estrogen. What do people typically, so when you have, you know, male patients come in, and you said not all of them resonate with the labels, anxiety, depression, or necessarily connecting to the idea they have a mental health condition or they're dealing with mental health concerns. What is typically the thing that brings them in? Is it a partner? Is it a friend? Or are they coming in with like fatigue? Like, what are you seeing?
Yeah. So, stress is a word that a lot of my patients resonate with. Certainly there are like lots of men with anxiety and depression that use those words. But I'm also screening when folks come in with IBS symptoms because there's a huge correlation there. It's never one thing, right?
Yeah, right.
It's always piecing it together and figuring out what's under the surface here. Like what's really the driver. So exercise intolerance.
That was a good one.
So just can't seem to exercise and being super frustrated by that.
It's interesting because I've never had a female patient with that being her main concern or main goal, but it's something that when we ask about, I always ask that, like, if you do push yourself to work out, how do you feel during, after, the next day? And sometimes people will say, yeah, you know, I pressure myself to go to the gym and I actually don't feel like after 5 minutes or 10 or 15 minutes that I actually get going. I feel like it's actually depleting me. So we dig once we start asking questions, but it's interesting that that's something that will bring them in, that that's a concern, because typically what brings us into
a shortness of breath and they feel like there's something like metabolically wrong.
Interesting.
Like move their body the way that they're used to. So symptoms that might look like not being able to play hockey normally, or feeling like they're trying to work out, but like they can't work out a certain body part. They feel like that like uses up too much of their stamina. So that's something that like a lot of times, one of the difference between, so I do see women in my practice as well, and probably a full number that I see men. And what I find to be the biggest difference in terms of like questioning and therapeutics, often see women and they haven't had a lot of testing. Their doctor has kind of said like, oh, it's just your period, or like you're just stressed out, you know, like that kind of thing.
You're just getting old. Exactly. You're 27.
You're like, no, I don't want that. Or they can't have that. Like that's not appropriate for them. So they're looking for something new. You know, men in my practice are coming in again, dissatisfied with the conventional treatment options, but often having been through a lot more testing. So sometimes, and that's just my experience. I don't know you know, what this process looks like. But sometimes, you know, these thyroid or even like diagnosis of subclinical thyroid disorders being already identified and medicated.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I've never seen in women. So,
So what we're talking about, just for context, is the idea of your thyroid being still within the reference ranges, but functioning suboptimally. And this is an area that we focus on as naturopaths, where we're looking at the combination of your symptoms and how that's showing up in blood work. But typically that wouldn't be treated in the conventional system. If your thyroid was within range, even though you were dealing with symptoms, you wouldn't be medicated or offered necessarily solutions or even more in-depth testing. I've had patients refuse testing because their thyroid stimulating hormone was within range. That's really interesting. Yeah.
I've seen men that have had testing and medication for subclinical hyperthyroid disorder.
Are they were they good at advocating, or was it just interesting. Yeah. That's so cool.
And I think, I mean, Talia, I don't know, every time I'm just like talking about privilege here, but like they're taken seriously. You know, we're talking, you know, about you know, patients that are able to advocate themselves that are white men.
Right.
And they are getting medicated. So,
and that's, and I think it's interesting because we talk about, so just, again, we're two women discussing this, but we were, you know, the conversation began with some of the disadvantages of being a male of any color in terms of the of mental health, like some of the unique disadvantages that a man might face or unique challenges. But then there's also this other side of it where we're seeing this discrepancy that we don't as feminists.
Access to testing, access to medication, and then still not resolution of those symptoms because we're not actually looking at the full picture, not seeing the totality, and whether that's coming from the patient side not acknowledging the totality or the practitioner side. I don't think it really matters. I think what's important is that we look forward to how do we get this appropriate testing across the board to all people, all genders. And again, that acknowledgement of human expression, human emotion across all people, all genders. And so we're able to say like, this is a scary symptom. It's hard to feel your heart racing. It's hard to not be able to breathe. But like if you've had a pulmonary test, which everyone that's having heart difficulty, trouble breathing, like, you know, let's check your lung function. And then if that's fine, we're left with all the anxiety that's causing you to have difficulty breathing. Let's allow that to be a real thing.
Right.
All humans experience. Because all humans experience that.
Well, it can be astounding, right? Especially if you haven't had a lifelong history of panic attacks or anxiety attacks, to really think like this is just my nervous system. This isn't, which essentially all shortness of breath and heart rate elevation is all still your nervous system. But the idea that it's anxiety can be really astounding because the symptoms are so severe and scary, right? So it's still.
And so broad throughout your system. There's so many different systems that can be really impacted by anxiety. And so uncovering that is always, you know, it just leads to a lot of different options in terms of then how do we move forward? How do we deal with this?
One of the things that my male friends or male patients who deal with mental health concerns often say or allude to is this idea of not being able to, or not having anyone to talk to, or not necessarily being able to express their emotional state. Like I think as women, I'll leave friends long 30-minute WhatsApp messages just going on and on about my problems. And that's totally, you know, it's free therapy. But I don't know if my male patients or male friends or male family members have people like that they discuss those kind of things with. And
so, I mean, I can't speak to your individual patients or family members, but as a population, the answer to that is very known, and it's no, they do not. And they are lonely. We have an epidemic of male loneliness right now. And it is driving, in my opinion, mental health crisis that I think we need to be working hard to get ahead of. It's very difficult. There's a lot of different factors influencing this. But a big one is just that scripting, having not caught up. I think, I don't know.
It's definitely
like my grandpa, you know, and like,
yeah, I was just going
to
say,
he had to like, you know, be friends with, and he's still kind of a loner, you know, and I think of my husband, and I think he's doing a good job of, you know, we're doing a good job together of building community for our life and our family. And so that like, we both have friends. There's certainly this level of like acceptability of women. There's a lot of different ways culturally, lots of different stories of having female friends, of having friends as a woman. And like as men, there's really just like bro culture.
Right.
And like that's golf buddies, drinking buddies. Like there's not a lot of depth there and not a lot of variety of story when you look in the media, right? Like when you watch movies about women, there's like girls that have roommates and people that go for coffee and like running groups and like all these different things. And like, when you think of like, I mean, here in Canada and like men's culture, you've got like, watching hockey and drinking, playing hockey and drinking afterwards, maybe playing golf in the summer because you can't play hockey. Like, I'm overgeneralizing, but what I'm saying is that there's not a lot of stories. There's not a lot of examples of real, a real connection. In that, you think even the movies that are out with dads getting together and doing dads groups, they're like making fun of them and like making these like incompetent men, when like that's not what I see in real life. What I see is like very engaged fathers who are incredible parents, who are leaning on each other. I think we just need to be telling those stories more and being more part of our narrative. It will protect. It will protect the mental health of half of our population.
Right.
To have good mental health. Just like we need to advocate for more testing for women. We need
More talking for men and more acknowledging women's thyroid symptoms.
Yes.
But I think it's typical, right? That so like the narrative or the stereotype or the statistic is that the women get together, and this is like, traditional societies and cultures. It's typically more like talking and discussing things. And with men, it's more about doing, sharing like activities, which, you know, the thing though that I often see and that you probably see too, is that in order to process, we're a very verbal culture. In order to process a lot of our thoughts and emotions, a lot of us need to talk it out. And or write it out, right? So we recommend journaling all the time. But if you're not able to talk, you often haven't fleshed out the narrative of a trauma or a situation you're dealing with.
I'm like, I'm almost with you.
Okay.
And what's holding me back is that there are other ways to get it out of your body. Right? And so I say to a lot of guys, like, we don't actually, like, I treat anxiety, I mean, we often don't spend a lot of time talking about the things that guys are anxious about. We don't do a lot of that because we're just focusing on kind of like, okay, can we identify the emotion and get it out?
Okay.
Like, sometimes it's kickboxing. It doesn't, like, it's that, like, physical release. And so, yes, it should be okay to talk about problems. But also, for any person, regardless of their gender, you don't have to talk about it to get it out of your body. You need a way to talk about it. Or you need a way to get it out. So, yes, women have been socialized to talk about it. You know, and...
Well, do you think it's also sort of, like, what you're not used to? So, someone who's, like, super verbal, who's always talking about their problems, but not really... moving that energy, may really benefit from just getting it out. And somebody who is sort of internalized it or suppressed it and hasn't sort of brought it up to consciousness may benefit from having it, from really sitting and acknowledging, even if it's just naming it as, oh, this is anxiety. And now I know I need to go.
I call it the catch and release. It's adapted from our diagramming class. Yeah, so I've got this catch and release method where it's like you've got to name the emotion. Like you have to find it and you've got to call it and then you got to let it go.
Right.
And okay. It doesn't matter what the feeling is, where it is in your body. Like, those things matter. Let's find out. Let's learn about them. Mm-hmm. But we don't have to talk about what the anxiety is. We just have to realize, like, I'm afraid right now, or I'm pissed off, or this, like, anxiety is coming up because I'm actually really sad about something and I'm grieving. Mm-hmm. When you can own, like, this is grief, and now I process it. And maybe, yeah, for some folks, that's like the best way for them to process is, or the best way to process this particular grief, because different griefs can look differently, might be to call someone, might be to get together. But it's also fine if you process that grief by like swimming laps in a pool.
Yeah, totally.
And I think that's like men or women, but it has to, it has to work for you. Right. Mm-hmm. And I hear what you're saying. Like, you know, maybe you're talking and talking and talking about it, it's not going anywhere, or you've never tried talking about it and it's not getting better. So I think it's like, how can we give an abundance of choices and figure out what's actually going to release it, right?
How do you help or distinguish or maybe coach around distracting versus doing that processing where you're swimming laps in the pool to like really move emotion?
I think the first piece is an awareness. So that there is a difference between, and honestly, I find a lot of people maybe need this to start with, is understanding there's a difference between distraction and processing.
Right.
And then it takes time to discern for yourself, which you're doing. Because they're both really helpful.
Totally. Right? Like, distraction is sometimes the answer.
And there's more feeling than you can process. You need to distract to keep yourself safe, because you've overwhelmed your ability to process that emotion. And so, so and then it becomes with, how are you feeling? How do you feel afterwards? So I don't know for you, but for me, if I have like a problem, then I distract myself. When the distraction's over, feeling's still there. It like doesn't, you know, watching reruns on Netflix doesn't actually make me feel less anxious, less sad, less anything. I feel what's going on the TV for a while, so I get distracted by it. So in that sense, it's not healing it. So if you go and you exercise, and at the end you're still feeling like, you know, you're distracted while you're swimming lengths because you're counting your lengths and you're in your groove, and then you get to the end of your swim and you're like, I still feel as sad as I did, then you didn't release anything.
I need to go cry now. Yeah.
You might need to whatever. Go cry. And that's totally fine. But sometimes you do feel less sad after that. And you feel like you've left, you know, like, I don't know, I've gotten out of the pool and felt like I've left something there.
Totally. Yeah. So going for walks is nothing. Yeah. Yeah, totally.
So it's about learning the reflection process. I don't know how you deal with the difference.
Yeah. I love that distinction, actually. I think that's so simple. It's kind of like we talk like, am I hungry or am I thirsty? It's like, well, if you drink water and you're still hungry, you were hungry. It's testing. My dad has this rule. He's like, every time he feels sick, he's like, I just eat to see if it's hunger. So it's kind of like, you know, are you distracting or are you processing emotions? Well, do the thing that usually helps. And then you can see why it helps afterwards. Because it was
And then learning to listen. You know, our bodies are talking to us all the time. And your body knows whether it needs to swim or whether it needs to cry. But if you don't yet, try it and then see how your body responds.
Yeah. And then you were also saying, which is really important, that sometimes emotions are very intense and then distraction's appropriate. And so you might feel better actually after you've distracted, because you've decreased that intensity by just taking focus off it for a little bit. But in that sense, it still works. It still applies. It's like what we're looking for is a feeling of relief and lessening.
My concern with distraction is always to like avoid the whack-a-mole, right? So when I find distraction, it removes the intensity, but there's still the same amount of processing that needs to get done, right?
Yeah.
So,
totally, yeah.
So like sometimes that's appropriate. Like if I'm in a situation where I don't feel safe, or I don't feel it's appropriate for me to be as emotional as I need to be at that time, it's totally fine to like whack that down. It's just going to pop up again. So we better find a time and space.
The more appropriate time, space, or
otherwise, it's going to pop up again when it's also not appropriate. And unfortunately, there's not a lot of socially appropriate spaces for men to have those pop up. So they get a lot of whack-a-mole. And that's really, that can be, that's really harmful.
Right. And that makes a lot of sense, right? I think sometimes, well, definitely with, in therapy or any kind of counseling, we're always talking about stabilization as first steps. And there's something that we talk, so meditation and mindfulness have gotten a lot of popularity in the last few years for good reason, because they're really great tools. But something that a lot of my patients with anxiety deal with is this paradoxical effect, where when they sit down to meditate, their anxiety comes raging forth. Mm-hmm. And there's often this feeling of failure or just a disconnection from the whole narrative, or, you know, I can't sit with myself, be with myself, because, you know, it makes me worse. And a lot of it is because once we remove those distractions, or the body is just not a safe place to access right away.
Yeah.
And so there's these things too, where then, you know, a distraction, stabilization become probably more appropriate first steps. It's all about learning to navigate that.
For sure. Yeah, definitely. Everything has its place. I just want to make sure that we're moving forward and bringing in like the most appropriate coping tools.
Yeah.
Well, Talia, I would love to talk to you forever, but I'm going to have a Tycho Brahe moment.
Yes. I'm going to finish my coffee, even though it is 2:44. I saw a meme being like, in dog coffees, I've only had one.
Awesome. Yeah.
Dog coffees. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm going to finish my first dog coffee of the day.
Sounds good.
And yeah, this will be on the group. So if you guys could comment below, ask questions, and we can do another video. Because I feel like we have, like we were just sliding into some real meat. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot here.
Totally. Yeah.
So hopefully we got the hormone questions out of the way.
Yeah, exactly. Basically, our synopsis was hormones are important, but in the context of all kinds of things. Well, I think hormones, right? Insulin, cortisol. So these are all hormones. We're not just talking about testosterone, right?
No, all the hormones. They matter a lot.
Neurotransmitters are also technically hormones.
Oh, new topic. Yeah. Neurotransmitters.
Mic drop that. All right, Kitty. Thank you so much.
All right.
And so guys, ask us questions. This is Dr. Katie. And I am Dr. Talia. Take care.
Bye.